Hello, Tiger Nation. I am Byron Hulsey, headmaster at Woodbury Forest School, and I would like to welcome you to the Woodbury podcast series. This podcast consists of informal yet substantive conversations with alumni, faculty, staff, and students. The conversations explore how Woodbury's core values empowered alumni to build a solid foundation for their lives, how those core values are taught today by Woodbury teachers, and how those values are put into practice by today's students. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Woodbury Podcast. Today, I'm joined by a former member of the English Department and Woodbury faculty member extraordinaire, Ted Blaine. I've known Mr. Blaine for a long while. He was my summer school teacher before I started my new boy year at Woodbury, and then he taught me AP English when I was a sixth former, and we've served together when I was on the faculty in the late 90s, and then when I was headmaster at Woodbury. So Ted and I go way back. And Ted, I really appreciate you taking a little time to join us on the Woodbury podcast.
It's nice to be invited, Byron. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And I've been looking forward to this. So we'll jump right into it. Ted, tell our listeners a little bit about you, where you grew up, where you went to college, how you got into the world of teaching, and ultimately, how did you find Woodbury? But start with the earlier stuff so that we can get the context right.
Well, I am a native of Virginia. I was born and raised in Roanoke. I attended the public schools here. I went right down the road to Washington and Lee University, and from there, a little farther down the road to the University of Virginia for a master's degree. It was only then that I ventured out of state for any great length of time. I spent 6 years working at a school in Georgia before I came back to Virginia and worked at Woodbury.
Ted, I'm assuming you were an English major at W&L.
I was an English major at W&L. I took lots and lots of English.
Was that a natural fit for you as you started at W&L? You knew right away you wanted to do that?
I did, though. I was looking at W&L and at UNC because they both had journalism schools. In the back of my mind, I was thinking that I might want to be a journalist, specifically writing longer pieces for magazines. I've always enjoyed writing, though I think that the great German-American novelist Thomas Mann was exactly right when he said that writers are people for whom writing is more difficult than it is for others. And I've always found that to be the case, that yeah. I struggle to get the right words in the right order. But that's why I'd rather write than to have a conversation like this, because I can edit myself and find the right words. But when I got to W&L, there's a kind of scuttlebutt on campus. You know how students talk. And the English department just had such a better reputation as a legitimate, serious major than the journalism school did. And lots of people I talked to said, look, if you want to be a journalist, learn something about the world. You can always learn how to be a reporter. You can always learn how to be a magazine editor, but you ought to have some kind of expertise. So English was just a natural fit for me, and I really, really liked that department.
That's good. I understand the dilemma there of kind of trying to choose a major that fits your interests, but also opens doors for what you might want to do going forward. And for you, that ended up being the world of teaching. And you shared with us briefly that your first teaching job was in Georgia. Tell us a little bit about that school and about your experience there.
It was a sad little school. I hate to say that. It had started as a school for mountain boys founded by Martha Berry. And I think it was 1902 when she started that school. It was a phenomenal story. I mean, she had this dream of helping mountain boys get educated, and that little school turned into a really great big phenomenon, which became Berry College eventually. Yeah. Berry College wanted to get its hands on that endowment that Martha Berry had built up, starting with the little high school part. The year after I left, they closed the place down. They closed the high school part down, and now Berry College is the only surviving element of Martha Berry's vision for that group. But what I got out of those 6 years that I spent there was a chance to do everything that you do in a school. And I do mean everything. I was driving a school bus. I was washing uniforms. I was advisor to every student publication. I was involved in the drama program. I mean, I was coaching, which is a real joke, but that just shows what a desperate little place it was. What I appreciate about that experience now is that it showed me that not every school has the resources and the opportunities that a place like Woodbury does. So when I got to Woodbury, Emmett Wright asked me what I was going to be earning if I returned to Berry Academy. Mm. And I know it's tasteless to talk about money, but I'm just going to talk about money. I said, they offered me $16,000 for my annual salary. And he said, I can't possibly pay you that much. I'll give you 12. And I didn't hesitate at all. I said, done. Yeah. Because I knew as soon as I visited the Woodbury campus, I knew that this was a school that knew how to do what it wanted to do and was doing it very successfully. So I would have, if he had offered me 8, I would have come because I just wanted to be a part of Woodbury Forest.
Did you know Woodbury by reputation, Ted?
I knew people from Roanoke who had attended Woodbury. Mm. Steve McBroom was a classmate who went to Woodbury, and his older brothers went to Woodbury. David and Wink Weaver were neighbors who had attended Woodbury. So I knew the school by reputation, but I never really set foot on the place until I interviewed in the winter of 1982.
Ted, what was it like to work on the faculty in the prime years of Emmett Wright?
It was great. I really, really loved working for Emmett. And that was because he was so terrifying. I mean, I was scared. I was scared to death of Emmett, but there was never any doubt about where he stood on anything. He was so very clear in his expectations, then I could just do my thing. And that didn't mean that he didn't call me in to reprimand me on a regular basis. That was all very professional. I think he and I had a good working relationship.
So his clarity, as stern and as direct as it might have been, you would say actually gave you latitude to do what you wanted to do. How's that?
There were strictures too. I mean, he was particularly sensitive about the language that people used on stage, for instance. Mm-hmm. He was very adamant about no improper language in plays. So there could be some restriction there. And that would be a place where I might run into a little conflict with him. But we just knew what the rules were, and we knew what the expectations were. And therefore, that you didn't have any problem with worrying over exactly what you ought to be doing.
And that kind of worry and that kind of confusion can ultimately sap us of our energy.
Oh, that's true. I guess that part of it for me was that I had come from a school where there was no consistency.
Yeah.
There, you never knew, say, if a student got caught violating a rule about drugs or alcohol, whether that student was going to be dismissed or not. If the student was caught cheating, you didn't ever know exactly what the punishment was going to be. And that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the clarity of Emmett. Yeah. Yeah. If you got caught drinking, you were going to be dismissed. And that turned out to be good for morale, just because there was no ambiguity about it.
Right. You should tell the listeners a little bit about tell them the story that you have shared with me about your time early on in your career when you were ferrying Mr. Wright back to Woodbury after a conference, and you asked him about if he had any good ideas about what you might put on stage.
Well, that was another one of those memorable times when I'm terrified because I'm driving Emmett Wright back from Northern Virginia to Woodbury, and it's just the two of us in the car, and I'm trying to come up with some kind of thing to talk about, and it's not really going very far. So I did bring up the topic of the play, and there was this little beat of silence before Emmett said, I hate plays. And that was the end of that conversation. But I don't know if I've told you this story or not, Byron, but when I was at UVA, I applied to Woodbury. I got a letter saying that I would be invited to an interview later on. So I went to L. Joe's and got myself a new shirt so that I could look nice for this interview. I got some alums from Roanoke to put in a good word for me or write some letters. And I went on this campaign to see if I could get an edge on the other candidates. And then I got another letter. It was obviously addressed to me or never would have arrived. But the letter inside was addressed to somebody else. Clearly, there'd been a clerical error and the envelopes had been stuffed improperly. So I got this guy's letter and he got my letter. And the content of both letters was the job has been filled and you're not going to be invited for an interview after.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
So instead of just shrugging that off and moving on, I was such a brash, foolish, idiotic and depressed graduate student who had no job prospects. Nothing was working out. So I called Emmett Wright and got him on the phone. And you know, Emmett, so yeah. You know already how foolish this was of me to do, but that's what I did. I got him on the phone. I told him what had happened. And at first he tried to be really apologetic. He said, I'm so sorry. We shouldn't have let that happen. I'm sorry about any problems. And I didn't let that go. I didn't just accept that. What I said was, well, I know that there are going to be some alums in Roanoke who are disappointed by this. And he made it very clear that he did not like being threatened. And my hands were trembling by the time I hung up the phone. This was back in the days when you actually did literally hang up a telephone because we all had landlines. I thought, okay, I have burned that bridge. I will never, ever get a chance to work at Woodbury Forest School ever again. So 6 years later, and I'm looking for jobs in Virginia. I'm applying all over the place, Episcopal, the Richmond School, to VES. But I didn't apply to Woodbury because I'm scared of, yeah, of, you know, the unpleasantness of what Emmett Wright might do to get a letter from me. But then I thought, you know, that's really stupid. Why don't you just write him and apologize? And that's what I did. I wrote him this letter and I just said, I don't know if you have an opening or not, but I've learned a lot in the last 6 years. I'm the idiot who called you up and was really rude to you. And I don't know if there's anything available or not, but I'd just like to take this opportunity to apologize. I came across a copy of that letter. I don't know why I had the presence of mind to keep a photocopy of it, but I did. I was looking for something else, and I found a copy of this letter, and I got choked up because that is by far the single most important document I've ever written in my life. If I had not written that little 150-word letter, I can't imagine a parallel life that could have possibly been happier than the one that I had at Woodbury. And he wrote back, he said, oh yeah, I remember. But he said, it doesn't matter, come on up.
Good for him. Well, I'm glad that he had the graciousness to and the wisdom to bring you to Woodbury. Ted, share with our listeners a little bit about your growth and development as a schoolman, as a teacher at Woodbury over the course of your career.
Obviously, loved being here from the outset, but my big challenge at Woodbury was to find a way to be fully engaged with the place when I was not going to be contributing to the athletic program. The athletic program here at Woodbury is so, so good and such a prominent part of community life. And I was just not going to be an effective coach. So I had to figure out some way to be involved. I didn't want to be on the sidelines, and I didn't want to be just doing the minimum. I wanted to be involved in as much of school life as I could. So I would start these discussion groups. For instance, I started a group called the Algonquin Society, which is just a really pretentious name, chosen because of the Algonquin Hotel, where writers from the New Yorker would gather to talk. So this was a group that was supposed to be an intermediate stage between the Current Events Club, which Nat Job ran and talked about what was going on in the newspapers, and the Book Club, which John Reimers and then Richard Barnhart ran. So this was for magazines. That was a lot of fun, and that got me involved with some students that I might not see in class. And then I started this group. I was really into pretentious names. I started this other group called the Writers Symposium, which was just a group for creative writers on campus to bring what they were working on to the group and read it aloud.
Yeah.
And that was also a whole lot of fun. And it was as inspiring to me as it was to the boys who came. So I would do little things like that. But, you know, I was always trying to get to the games to watch and trying to do things with my advisees so that I could be a full member of the community. That was not work. That was fun.
You haven't really touched on how you entered into and then flourished in the world of the theater at Woodbury.
That was just a nice set of circumstances. In the spring of 1983, I was assigned to be an assistant track coach. Perry Epps was going to do a production of Macbeth for the spring play. So I went to Red Karn, the head of the athletic program, and Tom Greenwood, who was the head track coach, and I asked them if I could switch from track to drama. And I'm paraphrasing now, but essentially the answer was, yeah, sure, Ted. Yes, go right ahead. Yeah. You want to
absolutely
start today, in fact. Yeah, that'd be good. Great. So that was a relief to them to get rid of this inept stopwatch holder. And I went up and helped Perry with that. And then I did summer school right after that and directed a couple of one acts. And I don't know, I had a lot to learn about that, obviously, but it felt like a good fit. It felt like something that I understood and could do. You know, that was a really, really fun part of my career at Woodbury.
Well, I tip my cap to you because I know that you directed so many plays that boys who did not consider themselves to be thespians jumped into and enjoyed and remember fondly as a definitive opportunity and experience that they enjoyed at Woodbury. So kudos to you for opening the theater up to so many Woodbury boys.
Well, that's a nice thing for you to say, but maybe they were coming out just because they knew that I wasn't a theater person either, that I was just some amateur who was putting on a show like Mickey and Judy in the...
Come on. Yeah, you've made many, many contributions to the world of Woodbury Theater. Ted, let's talk a little bit about something that I know is near and dear to you, and that is the power and the energy, the positive energy and the love around friendships that I know you developed at Woodbury among colleagues that were close to you, among many of the boys that you taught and their families. And many of these relationships, of course, carry on to today. And I know you, like many of us, are still grieving the loss of some of our Woodbury Titans on the faculty who died recently.
Yeah, it's been a bad year for retired Woodbury faculty.
Yeah.
People, it's terrible. Dick Glover, Nat Job, Bob Davies, now Mike Sadlowski. That's quite a group for one calendar year.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that my experience with friends and friendships is very typical of the whole community. I mean, sure, I have lots of friends that I worked with and lots of friends with families with whom I worked. But I think that's very typical of any Woodbury faculty member. I don't think that I'm at all unusual in that way.
No, I don't. I wasn't suggesting that you are, but I think for many of our listeners, they may not really understand the depth of these relationships as it relates to those of us who live here and you know, work here and thrive. We hope thrive here. So that's it wasn't as if I was trying to call you out as unusual there, but maybe just to share with folks who may not know what it's like to be here, how that has added to your life.
It's essential. I got to Woodbury from Berry Academy, and at Berry Academy, a typical invitation from another faculty member could be something like this. We're having a party on Saturday night. Bring your own meat and whatever you want to drink, plus a vegetable dish for 12. And I'm thinking, you know, I can't afford to go to this party.
Right. That's a high bar.
When I got to Woodbury, people were just inviting me over for dinner. And I wasn't being taxed for the privilege to come over. And so I started having people over for dinner, too, and reciprocating. And I think that one of the reasons that Woodbury boys love the place so much is that they are at the school at one of the most, or probably the most formative time of their lives.
Yeah. I mean,
there's such a huge change between age 14 and age 18.
Yeah.
And not just physically, but intellectually. And so they're going through all kinds of really tumultuous moments in their own lives, and they count on their friends to see them through those times. They also count on their faculty parents to see them through. What Woodbury alums might not realize is that the faculty is also going through some tumultuous times. I mean, you can get tired if you are a coach who is driving back from Norfolk Academy and then you have class the next morning. You can get tired if you're on AM duty and you're up until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and you have class the next morning. And the faculty members count on their friends to get them through the hard times too. It's a really tight community. So I'm keeping up with the Parkers and the Barnharts and lots of people who had retired, but are still close friends.
Ted, you made so many of us better. I know you would say that there were people on the Woodbury faculty who made you better. Might you just share a little bit about, say, Nat Job or Perry Epps or John Stilwell and the mentors that you had?
John Stilwell was assigned to me as my official mentor when I came to Woodbury. And that was quite an education. He's the one who showed me that you could actually plan an entire trimester for your course. In my previous school, it had been pretty much day to day or maybe week to week. But the idea that you could actually write a syllabus for an entire trimester was absolutely new to me and quite revealing. That was hugely important. I also got to sit in on his classes to see how he engaged with the students and how he was he managed that brilliant John Stilwell thing that he did, where he was clearly the one in charge, but at the same time, everybody was relaxed and everybody was having a good time and everybody was enjoying learning. And I would just watch that and think, how does he do that? I want to be able to do that. I wonder if I can ever learn how to do that. Perry Epps asked me to team teach AP English with him. And again, I just got to watch him and realize that high school could be an extremely intellectual experience, that it did not have to be immediately accessible to everybody. You could push people, you could challenge people, you could ask them to discover just how much they were capable of doing when they didn't even realize it. Perry had written a book, and Mac Moore had written books, and suddenly I'm with people who actually were writers. And I had tried to write a novel when I was back in Georgia. I'd written a complete draft of a novel, but it didn't work. I mean, it was just an exercise in seeing if I could get to the end of something. But being around these people who were actually doing it made me think that I could do it too. And I did.
Yeah, you sure did. I remember one thing I'll say about Nat Jobe that I've never forgotten and has been useful for me as an educator is that in Nat's presence, I felt like I was introduced to the world of ideas in a dynamic kind of high level engagement. But I did not ever believe that I knew that Nat expected me to do my best, but I also understood that Nat wanted us to appreciate that these ideas are never finished. And that therefore, if we're learners, we're never finished either.
And of course, he set the example, always reading, always finding the new book, always pursuing the new article. Nat and I team taught an American Studies class for 3 years, and that was a real tutorial for me in everything from learning more about American history to classroom manner and classroom atmosphere. He was just so good. He was such a natural. This is a silly comparison, but you watch Fred Astaire out there tap dancing, and he makes it look so easy. He's doing these impossible things, and he just makes it look so easy. And that's the way Nat was in the classroom. Yeah. He was doing these astonishing things and getting these amazing results. He just made it look so natural. But try to copy it, try to do that yourself, and you realize how hard it is.
It is hard. Ted, tell us a little bit about life after Woodbury. In retirement, how are you spending your time? What's restoring you and giving you energy now?
Right after I retired, I wrote a short story about an English teacher at a boarding school campus who was isolated because of COVID. All the classes were happening on Zoom. You could tell probably that this was a bit autobiographical.
Yeah.
That was my last trimester at Woodbury. It was the only trimester I ever spent at Woodbury when I was really sad and lonely. The only time I ever felt lonely at Woodbury because we were so isolated. And I was leaving and I don't know, it was just a bummer of a time. It was terrible for the seniors who missed out on the spring and senior year. But of course, we faculty members enjoyed the spring as well. So I wrote this story. I did not know whether anybody would ever want to read a short story about something like that. But I sent it in to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. There was a mystery element to it, which was all fiction, of course. To my amazement, not only did they publish it, but it won the Reader's Award for that year. So the readers of the magazine chose it as their favorite story of the year. And I got to go to New York to pick up the the prize. That was nice, and that was a direct result of a bad time that got to be turned into something good. And I remember that. I hang on to that. My mom just turned 100 years old a couple of months ago. She's got dementia. She can't walk. She can barely see. She's in a nursing home. I see her every day. And while that's very, very sad to watch, it's also such a blessing to be able to help her out.
Yeah.
It really is like having a child to look after. I'm also her unofficial property manager and business manager, and unofficial means unpaid, but I'm looking after her house and paying her bills. And that's a good avocation for me too. But I'm back in my hometown of Roanoke. I know lots of people here. The social life is really good. The arts are good here. The scenery is beautiful here.
Yeah.
I'm doing a lot of reading and not as much writing as I wish I could do or ought to be doing, but I'm still doing that too.
Ted, as we get ready to sign off, I wanted to close with some of your humor and ask you if you would to recount maybe just a couple of the pieces that were informal expressions of your writing. Some of the maybe the AM reports that you wrote in over the years, but even more particularly that we all appreciated and enjoyed those bonfire missives and those April Fool's missives that you would send out electronically. Share with us a couple of your own remembered highlights about those pieces.
Okay, Byron, if you insist, I will go back and visit that. But you've got to understand that that was simply a self-indulgence on my part. Woodbury was great for letting me scratch my creative itch. When I was younger, I would get up early in the morning and write fiction before I went to class. And as I got older, I just couldn't do that anymore. But I still had this impulse to be writing something creative. So the bonfire offered opportunities to do that. It was really amazing what people would believe. And I guess the most unbelievable one for me was the year when we had the bonfire canceled because the bonfire had been built with marijuana logs. And the smoke from the marijuana logs would be dangerous for the community. So we had to, and people believed that. It's amazing. The April Fool's thing just started as an April Fool. You know, I thought, you know, I could do this. So I sent out this announcement saying that I'm sorry to everybody on the faculty, but all the English classes would be traveling to Norfolk Academy tomorrow for a poetry slam, and we would be missing classes. We're going to be jamming, rapping in this big poetry slam at Norfolk. And so no students would be in classes that day. And people on the faculty went berserk.
Yeah.
they were so furious. And I just didn't expect anybody to believe that, but they did.
All right. Well, this has been terrific, Ted. I've really enjoyed it. And we miss you here at Woodbury. I hope you come back often. I always enjoy our times together and appreciate all that you have done and are continuing to do for us at Woodbury Forest.
Byron, you were so nice to invite me to do this. And I will finish on this note. I said that last trimester was lonely and sad and depressing, but you redeemed that. You yourself redeemed that the following year when you invited me to come back and be the graduation speaker for the class of 2021. So that let me say goodbye to the school and the school to say goodbye to me. And that was just a really nice thing for you to do.
Well, it was very appropriate, and we all benefited from that moment. And it was a reminder of how much you have meant, and as I said, continue to mean to us at Woodbury Forest. So that was my pleasure. Ted, thanks so much for being on the podcast. We wish you the very best, and thank you again for all you do for Woodbury Forest.
Thanks for inviting me, Byron. It was a pleasure.
Take care to our listening audience. Go Tigers.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Woodbury Podcast. We hope you found our discussion insightful and engaging. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing, rating, or leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. Stay tuned for more conversations in the future. And remember, the conversation doesn't have to end here. Connect with us on Woodbury Forest School social media, reach out with your questions or comments, and let's keep the dialogue going. Until next time, take care and go Tigers!